A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
I can't believe I'm saying these words. Donald Trump is the president-elect of the United States. How did we get here? How did Hillary Clinton screw this up? And what does this mean for the future of our country? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is our special guest. Welcome, everybody. So this still doesn't feel real to me, but it is. Donald Trump is going to be our president in a matter of a couple of months. I've been watching the range of reaction from people who didn't want Trump to win, and I'm trying to place myself somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, not despondent, but definitely not blasé about it either. At this point, Donald Trump's successes and failures are about to be all of our successes and failures, and we need to figure out what we can do to maximize the upside of his presidency and minimize the damage while keeping ourselves sane and protected in the process. So what do we do now? Let's go around the table. Dahlia, where are you sitting 3 days after the election?
I think I'd file myself under despondent, Josh. I am, you know, principally what I cover is the law and the courts, and I'm looking down the barrel of a nominee who, in ways that we have never seen before, has run on the premise that the Constitution doesn't matter. Immediately, we're going to tweak the First Amendment and change press rights. Immediately, we're going to tweak the Fourth Amendment and institute national stop and frisk. You know, you can go on and on. Eighth Amendment, we're going to torture people. Not only that, we're going to kill their families. I mean, I've never seen, at least in my lifetime, a president who openly runs on the principle that he's not constrained by the rule of law, and that, in fact, the law exists for him to crush others. And so in my world, and I say this almost, I think, universally across the board, because you're hearing it from the conservative legal thinkers as much as the liberal legal thinkers, it's kind of terrifying to be at the precipice of a time where there's no law and there's no constitution and there's no check. So that's where I am, but I am persuadable.
Rich, where do you stand? Are you at the despondent end as well?
No, I'm cautiously hopeful. My posture now is hoping for the best. I mean, there's enormous substantive upside for someone where I am on the political spectrum. I mean, the chances are we are going to get a robustly constitutionalist Supreme Court nominee. I don't think that's 100%, but I think the odds are pretty good. And you know, basically, within the party now, the populists control the presidency and the conservatives control the Congress. And if you look at the domestic agenda, if you end up with something in the middle there, somewhere on that spectrum, and it passes in the first year, that's going to be an enormous legislative accomplishment. Now, there are obviously downsides and enormous risks to Donald Trump, which we have discussed for a year or so. But I'm hoping that the institutions and the rituals will constrain him. And at least the first couple days here were encouraging, because when he was immediately after election night sort of swallowed into this maw of the rituals around the peaceful transfer of power, he played his part, as did everyone else, Hillary Clinton to her credit and President Obama as well.
David, where are you standing?
I would describe myself not as despondent, but as alarmed. And my scale of alarm would be, if you've seen the movie Spinal Tap, would be 11. and I want to direct attention to three things that really should make you alarmed. First, Donald Trump is going to become quite a popular president in the early phases. He is about to have a massive fiscal stimulus, huge tax cut, big spending on infrastructure, big defense buildup, total disregard For the deficit. Remember, Donald Trump's central business idea is borrow as much money as you can and then never pay it back. It worked for him as a businessman, he believes. Why couldn't it work for a country? In fact, he said as much. Massive fiscal stimulus in an economy where wages have already begun to rise, this is the first quarter in which we've had strong wage growth, is going to translate into a rapid improvement in revenues to a lot of people. And the spending will be concentrated in ways that particularly benefit blue-collar men. This is not going to be the soft infrastructure of the Obama years. This is going to be bridges, highways, airports, things that require people actually to drive earth-moving equipment. And those jobs are predominantly male. So he will be popular. And my guess is 6 months from now, a year from now, certainly, he'll be at about a 50% approval rating, which is pretty good in the modern era. So that's the first thing. The second thing is Congress will totally lay down for him. I don't agree with Rich. This is a balance. It's a deal, but I think Republicans in Congress will be conscious they are losers. He's a winner. They are successful and can achieve their goals only to the extent that they follow him. And Donald Trump's habit of periodically humiliating people who get too big will have its impact on congressional morale. So Congress, I think, will be subservient. And the last thing is, we talk about institutions. There are no institutions. There are only people. People acting collectively. And we have seen over the past decade and even longer than that, that the norms by which American government was made to work have been weakening. And good people will justify doing things that their parents and grandparents would never have done for the sake of ideology and party. And in this administration, while the good people do that, there will be more bad people in higher positions of power than in any administration ever. I mean, that Richard Nixon did have his Haldemans and Ehrlichmans, but he also had Bill Ruckelshaus and Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I think even if you see relatively quality people taking cabinet departments, or at least that, you know, you've got half of them are relatively quality people, that the White House is going to be filled with people who are of whom we should be very nervous.
So I think this question of will Congress roll over for Donald Trump or not is going to be fascinating and in some ways complicated. And I've been really interested watching over the last 3 days the overtures that have occurred between Donald Trump and Democrats. The first policy issue that Donald Trump talked about in his acceptance speech was an infrastructure package, clearly a high priority for him. It's something that Republicans in Congress had been signaling through the campaign was not a priority of theirs, but you had statements out from people like Nancy Pelosi saying they're eager to work with a President Trump on an infrastructure package. You have seen fairly conciliatory statements from other Democrats indicating a willingness to work with him. Somebody is talking to Bloomberg News about how important the relationship between Chuck Schumer, the likely Democratic minority leader in the Senate, and Donald Trump is going to be on policy. And when I look at this, you know, I actually think back to the way that Donald Trump treated Fox News Channel and CNN in the very early days of his campaign, which is that Trump announced and everyone sort of thought, well, Trump and Fox are a match made in heaven. He's conservatives ratings gold and they'll love him. But Trump knew that there were people at Fox who didn't want him to be president, and he needed to be able to credibly threaten to boycott them, to hold them accountable, and he needed somewhere else to go. So he developed this deep relationship with CNN. There were a bunch of exclusives that he was giving to CNN early in the campaign that people were surprised about. And so I look at Trump dealing with Congress, and he's going to say, I don't want to come into Washington and just do whatever Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell tell me to do. And if he wants to be able to work around them and to tell them that they don't get to set the agenda, he needs open lines to work on both sides of the aisle. And I think this could end up in all sorts of weird directions. I'm not saying this fully, hopefully, saying that I think he's going to end up being a centrist president, but I do think it injects a certain amount of randomness and unpredictability into what President Trump will do.
On election night, the first one to give President-elect Trump a call should be Chuck Schumer. And he should say, Mr. Trump, you are so brilliant. Donald, can you believe these two guys? You know, I'm from Brooklyn, you're from Queens, we're running this country. And just butter him up. That's the way to influence him. Pull a Putin on him and praise him to the hilt and sort of do a good cop, bad cop thing. I think Schumer's shrewd enough to do that. But even, let's say, there's no give whatsoever and just Trump gets everything he wants. He's run on a program that substantial portions of which are perfectly fine, and what Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell want to do: repeal Obamacare, a big tax cut, major regulatory rollback, and there is a very good chance most of that's going to happen.
Dahlia, I think there's going to be a big internal debate among Democrats about how much to work with Trump and on what. You're seeing these protests erupting in the streets, clearly people extremely upset about the election result, saying things like, not my president. A lot of people are looking to what Mitch McConnell did in 2009, just basically trying to stand in opposition to everything President Obama did, trying to delegitimize his presidency. There are going to be a lot of people on the left who will want to do that with Trump and will think that that's important to prevent normalizing him. Which of these do you think is the right approach? Do you think Democrats should be preparing to work with him?
Well, I think of all people, Elizabeth Warren was making noises this week about working with him. And I think that for the people who didn't want to give him that quarter, who wanted to see Democrats, I don't think anyone expected Obama or Hillary Clinton to say, you know, we're giving you one term and we're going to wreck your life. I don't think that was the expectation. But I think many of them were probably alarmed by the extent to which we heard someone like Elizabeth Warren say, and I too am for reaching across the aisle and working with him. But I think we're in a position where, you know, this is what we have. And I think you can probably at some point look at Elizabeth Warren as very realistic in saying, look, we lost everything. If we want anything, we're going to have to begin with the things that we agree upon, whatever they may be, and try to get some good feeling and some ability to work in a bipartisan fashion about something. But I have to say, I was with the people who were just shuddering watching Obama and Hillary Clinton say, let's give him a chance, only because, and I agree with you, Josh, if he succeeds, we all succeed, let's stipulate, but only because had Hillary Clinton prevailed, we would have been having 4 years of lock her up in Benghazi. And so the feeling that one side always puts on the big boy pants and behaves honorably and the other side was willing to do exactly what happened in terms of delegitimizing and disempowering Obama, I think is very frustrating for progressives today.
To people who are liberal or even left, I really entreat you to take this seriously. Over the next 4 years, a lot of things are going to happen that are going to be very alarming and disturbing. The future of the rule of law in the United States really is in question. I don't know in one term how much damage you can do, but as I said, I think he's going to be a popular president, and there may be two. If you are moved to protest, do it in ways that people find attractive and convincing, not in ways that make you look like a jerk. Do things that people like, not things they don't like. Carry the flag. Treat it with respect. Don't block traffic. If you have veterans in your group, put them in the front. If you have people who know how to smile, put them in the front. Remember the most powerful exponents in this campaign were the Kahn family, people who accepted American norms. Accept them yourself, because don't concede the flag to the people who are attacking the Republic and the Constitution. That's not their flag. And you, the people who are defending the Republic and the Constitution, own the flag.
Matt Iglesias wrote something very interesting on this week. He was alluding to this idea that some of the protests have been politically unproductive, but then he's also been pointing out that people are really angry out there. They have rage. They feel the need to... No, but the thing, what he was saying is that someone needs to lead the movement, that there needs to be somebody on the left who is figuring out how to take this energy and channel it in a productive direction, because the protesters are—they're not all listening to you, David. Like somebody—it's not.
I'm
not
always right. People should. The Republicans had listened to me 8 years ago. We wouldn't be in this fix today.
I think this is demonstrably different than what Republicans felt, unless Republicans really believed 8 years ago that Obama was breaking down their doors and taking their guns, and you know all the other ridiculous fictions about how pernicious and dangerous he was. I think we have to agree at least this. Liberals in this country, minorities in this country, women in this country are terrified. They are terrified in no small part because Donald Trump has aligned himself with really frightening alt-right groups, with, you know, white supremacists, with haters, and I hate that word. But I think you just need to understand that what is happening on the streets is also visceral and personal. This isn't about policy disagreements. This isn't just 22 million people are going to lose their health care. This is a man who really, I think, has in every way telegraphed that if you are a minority or if you are a woman, you should be very afraid of me and my administration. Okay, and some of that isn't about growing up. Some of that
is all about growing up. Not to hog the mic here, I'm sorry. But look, one of the things that is really one of the things that has destroyed the left, one of the things that has made this victory possible, is precisely that it validates feelings and self-indulgence and, you know, my identity as a fill-in-blank over any political end. The people, all those dark forces behind Donald Trump, I see them as clearly as you do. They hate the flag. Many of them are literal Nazis. Many of them either find the Nazis enjoy. If you go to their sites, they have other symbols. They don't have American symbols. And if I'm right, I hope I'm not, but I fear I am, that basic tenets of Americanness are under threat, then the people want to defend those. They own America, and they own the symbols of the state. They own the symbols of the republic, and they should treat them with respect. And they should remember that there's a bigger country out there that made it for reasons that are somewhat sympathetic and somewhat not, made a bad choice, or at least just enough of them in the right strategic places to be less than plurality. They made that choice. They're your fellow citizens too, and they have to be rescued from a destiny that they're not going to like much better than the people who are going to be its primary victims.
We need to take a quick break. Let us know what you think about what we're going to do after this at kcrw.com/LRC. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC. This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. Something I've been afraid of that goes to something David was talking about earlier in the show is that I can fairly easily foresee a circumstance in which Donald Trump is a president who produces pretty decent economic outcomes through a result of luck and a combination of policies from the right and the center and the left that he wants that will be stimulative. And at the same time, he could be a horrible president on a variety of other dimensions. But those good economic results will produce popular support from him, including in some cases from members of some of the groups that will be under attack from him. We still need to make sense of exactly what the exit polls mean and how accurate they were. But it looks like he actually did better with black voters and maybe even a little bit better with Hispanic voters than Mitt Romney had. And so if Donald Trump has an administration that is at the same time producing jobs and wage increases and oppressing minority groups, I think he could see support even from some members of those groups that do not feel the oppression so personally. And so I guess my broad question is, how do we deal with that circumstance? How do you talk to a country about the idea that their pocketbooks are fine, but broader, really scary things are happening?
Well, I'm not sure what these scary things are going to be. I mean, on immigration, for instance, I mean, I think what we'll see him do, he'll reverse the Obama executive orders. There'll be some more structure on the border. I doubt there's going to be an enormous wall on the border. And you know, I remember calling him President Trump. That used to seem so weird. It doesn't seem so weird anymore.
He told you people to stay off drugs.
He has a broad practical streak. He's going to, he's had a genius throughout his career for declaring things wonderful victories that are partial victories at best. And what is he? I mean, is he going to go around rounding up blacks? I mean, what is the vision here?
What if he wants to make Muslims register by their religion?
He's not going to do that.
Well, but so the thing is, I don't think he's going to do it tomorrow. But what I'm afraid of is this is a man who does not handle pressure well. And so I'm afraid of how he responds to crises. I think if we had a four-year administration that had no significant crises, we might get through it just fine. But if there's a terrorist attack on American soil on the scale of 9/11, I think the reaction that he could have to it could be very rash and very destructive. And I also think that what he's likely to do on foreign policy will increase the risk of great crises. So I worry about what he will do when a crisis creates the opportunity for extreme reaction. And I think it will be unpredictable. I think that he might come up with awful things to do that we haven't even thought of.
Yeah, well, this is what I'll say is, one, I think the main threat to the success of his administration obviously is characterological. He will have to resist his worst impulses in a way he's never been able to before and couldn't even this week when his late night tweet about the protesters. You know, this is a man who's just gotten one of the biggest ego boost that's possible to get on the planet. Only several dozen people in the history of the world have gotten a similar ego boost, and he's wounded by a couple thousand stupid kids
in the street. This is him tweeting that the protests were very unfair.
Were very unfair.
Amusingly, the following morning, he then tweeted basically, love your passion. Both tweets came from his personal phone. So
Obviously,
he slept on it. He felt a little better.
And the areas where he'll have most discretion are trade, which he feels very strongly about and I think potentially has very destructive views, and on foreign policy. So there will inevitably be crises, and it will be a risk how he responds to them. But a lot of what he said, you know, the parade of horribles from Dahlia, it's really boob bait for his supporters. It's to gin them up. It's to create excitement, to create emotion. It's demagoguery that I don't believe he has an intention of falling through on.
Dahlia, what do you make of that?
I mean, I think Rich and I probably agree more than we disagree. But on this issue, I think it's not ginning up his supporters. I think that the response to immigration, or obviously he's not going to build a wall, but stop and frisk, massively worsening already deteriorating relationships between minority communities and the cops, talking about torture cavalierly, talking about imposing Christian religious values in ways we have never seen a president do. I don't think this is nothing. And I think that the assertion that, well, it's just not going to happen because it's so horrible is kind of how we got Trump in the first place.
But how would this even work? How would he impose stop and frisk on local police departments across the country? How would we, you know, taking on opposing Christian values, maybe his maximalist promise on this was that people would say Merry Christmas again. How is he going to do that? You know, these are things that are beyond his power. He's going to focus on real concrete achievements and then praise them to the hilt.
I just don't see that you have a Congress who opposes any of these things. I think you have a Congress who very much supports his views on women's reproductive freedom and on women's basic freedom. I think that you're very much going to see somebody who is unopposed, I guess David said this too, by the entities that are supposed to check him and unopposed by courts that are very excited about reinserting church into life, daily life as we know it. So the idea that there's no constituency for this, Rich. Very much, I think he was elected on the principle that there is a constituency for some of this. Of course, he can't enact stop and frisk. That's a local policing problem. But I think that to sort of throw away everything he said about every component of the Constitution and say, oh, of course he can't initiate libel laws. He's the president. That's a constitutional prerogative, is to absolutely ignore the impulse behind that, which is to repress and to disempower. And I think the idea that all he's going to worry about is trade once he gets in office is to ignore that there is massive support for some of these values.
Can I say, I think we're looking up the wrong street. If you're having a discussion that is the same discussion as you'd be having if Ted Cruz were president-elect, you're having the wrong discussion. The question here is not that a President Trump will appoint judges who will be more restrictive of abortion rights, as a President Cruz would have done. I mean, if you're a liberal on this issue, that's very upsetting to you. I understand that. That's not a violation of the rules of the game. You lose enough elections, you get an abortion regime you don't like. You think, you know, sometimes people want harsher policing, sometimes they want more gentle policing. That's within the rules of the game. That when you're thinking about the things that are going to go wrong, don't think judges who say things I don't like. Think Bridgegate. Think of routine, petty abuses of power concealed beneath layers of absolute non-transparency by a government that will be the least ethical, the administration that will be the least ethical and least transparent in the modern history of the presidency. And if Trump is going to be contained, he's going to be contained by a trans-ideological alliance of people who say, you like abortion, I oppose it. You know, you have this idea about how policing should be done. What we all agree on is that the president shouldn't take bribes. We all agree on that. That the president and the chief of staff should not be somebody with a record of criminal assault. I think we can all agree on that. And when you find yourself talking about things that are normal political things, you're talking about the wrong things.
Yeah, this is where I feel a little bit better about the institution stuff. You know, I agree that there will be a conservative shift in the courts, at least of the normal form that you have with a Republican president appointing conservative judges to courts. But I don't think, for example, if if President Trump tries to impose unconstitutional restrictions on the press. I don't think Clarence Thomas and John Roberts are going to go along with that, even if Trump can find new justices to appoint who would do that, which would be a departure from the list that he has put out, which is a list of judges who are too conservative for my taste, but who are not authoritarians of the sort that Donald Trump is. So I do think where my faith is strongest in the institutions is in the judicial branch to stop the abnormal things he would do, not necessarily the normal Republican things he would do, and in the Senate. And I actually think executive appointments are going to be an interesting issue here. Republicans are only going to have 52 seats in the Senate. If Donald Trump wants to fill the cabinet with a bunch of weirdos and cranks, he will need 50 Republicans plus Mike Pence to approve each of those appointments. And we've seen the Republican Party has not been a profiling courage about Trump in general, but resistance has been stronger than normal in the Senate. And I think people like Ben Sasse and Mike Lee and Lindsey Graham are likely to be something of a check on him there.
So what if you get a normal Secretary of State and a normal Secretary of Defense and an abnormal White House Chief of Staff and an abnormal White House National Security Advisor, neither of those latter two positions requiring Senate confirmation? The trouble is not going to be in the Senate confirmed positions.
So I guess let's then talk about foreign policy and the risks there. Donald Trump has talked about NATO being obsolete, but then he's said a variety of sometimes alarming, sometimes not alarming, contradictory things on this. What should we be afraid of in international relations? Because I thought a key moment in the campaign was the Enrique Peña Nieto meeting in Mexico, because as it was about to happen, I was looking at it and being like, this can't happen. You can't just call up Mexico and be like, I want to come meet with the president tomorrow. And then he goes down there and has this sort of inexplicably successful meeting. The president of Mexico treated with him with a respect that I would not have expected the president of Mexico to. I'm wondering, is the international relations stuff maybe not as hard as we thought it was? Is there going to be a certain amount of give in the international system where other foreign leaders are going to realize they have to work with the erraticness of Donald Trump and find ways to cushion it?
Look, I'm going to be alarmist again. In order to understand our relationship with Mexico, I invite people to Google Mexico President New Plane. Take a look at Nieto's plane, and that will tell you everything you need. It's got a fireplace. Nieto is a kleptocrat. Trump is an aspiring kleptocrat. They have a lot to talk about. He'll have a lot to talk about with leaders in the post-Soviet space. He'll have a lot to talk about with leaders in Southeast Asia. He's like them. They'll get along fine. But the worst thing he's going to do as president in the first year, he's already done. Once you say, maybe we'll honor a NATO commitment, maybe not, there's only one way to find out, you've already done it. The key thing to understand about a president is there's no distinction between words and deeds. Words are deeds. And when you say that the pledged commitment of the United States since the signing of the NATO treaty may or may not be null and void, no one will ever get that out of their head ever again.
Are you terrified of this, Rich? Are we going to end up in a war in Eastern Europe?
Well, that's the danger. And Josh, you put your finger on this a couple months ago. The danger is that Putin has gotten a message that perhaps Trump didn't intend to send, and he will push it too far, create a crisis, and Trump will realize either that our national interest is at stake or his manhood has been offended. And then you could get a completely unnecessary, horrific crisis. But is he going to go out and just rip up the NATO treaty as soon as
it's
he
ripped.
Walks in? Well, he's not going to. He's not. I just think a lot of this stuff, he's going to want to focus on other things. And, you know, if he's going to tear up the WTO or tear up NAFTA, he could spend 2 years of his administration trying to do that. Or he can actually rack up accomplishments that will make him, as you point out earlier, David, popular. And I may be naive, but I think he's going to tend towards that option.
He's going to do both.
I mean, if Putin invades Estonia, Trump isn't going to have a choice as to whether he wants to focus on the NATO alliance or not.
That's correct. I'm just saying he's not going to pull us out of NATO. Now, he may have already made a catastrophic mistake with regard to our credibility and deterrent there, but I don't think he's going to be purposely disruptive in a way that would consume his administration when he's going to want to, as all early presidents do, put points on the board.
Rich, it's already happened. Read the statement that Angela Merkel made of congratulation to Donald Trump, in which she said that Germany looks forward to cooperating with the United States. She didn't congratulate him. She looked forward to cooperating with him on the basis, and then she specified a half a dozen liberal values. There are two great facts about German politics. One is the country's intense commitment to liberal values as a result of terrible experiences in mid-century, and the other is its chafing under American and British tutelage. What has been true since World War II is those people who want to be liberal insist on being aligned to the United States because the United States is a protector of liberal values, and they point out that those people who want to leave the United States are people who are illiberal in one way or another, communist or fascist. We now already have a dynamic in which those Germans who want distance from the United States can say, you can be distant from the United States and also liberal at the same time. In fact, that's the more liberal future. And Germany, with Britain out of the EU, our best friend, the country that shares the values most clearly in that part of the world, Germany is already adrift, already moving. That's the central question in European politics since 1870, and it's back on the table, and it's already there. This is not what Trump will do. It's what he has done.
Dahlia, I want to get you in on this quickly before we go to break.
No, I was just going to restate what I think we've all said in different ways, which is all you need is id Trump to show up once, right? We can all hope that superego Trump or his advisors show up 80% of the time. But in a crisis situation, in a world that he has destabilized, if id Trump shows up just once, that's quite enough.
Well, let us know what you think about that scary thought at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page, or you can message us on Twitter. We're at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, a look at how we got here. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left today is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is our special guest. So as all of this has happened, I cannot help but be somewhat consumed by anger toward Hillary Clinton, who, how do you screw this up? Like, running against this joke of a candidate who was seen as unqualified for the presidency by 60% of the electorate, and she managed to lose. And I think that there were clear weaknesses of hers that she did not take efforts to mitigate, because from her shell shock from the 90s, her view had basically been, people are going to say all sorts of things about me. There's no reason to even try to change my public image because it's baked in. And then obviously her campaign that thought it had this, you know, immensely vaunted data and get out the vote operation did not work. They did not turn toward the Midwest until too late. And I just feel like she was supposed to be what was standing between us and Trump, and she failed. And more broadly, the Democratic Party failed because they did not subject her to a primary campaign against any real candidate except Bernie Sanders, who at the outset we didn't even think was a real candidate. And then he got 43%. And if there had been a broader, normal field of Democratic candidates, I think it's very likely that she would not have emerged as the nominee, because she turned out to be a much weaker candidate than everybody in the Democratic Party believed. So now that I've got that little bit of venting off my chest, I think we should just go around and talk about, what did we miss? Why was this election so much closer than we thought it would be? And how did Trump manage to pull this off? Rich, let me start with you.
Well, she was a terrible candidate, and that was clear all along. And you saw it again and again, how there was an impressive machine and apparatus around her. The convention was one of the most effective conventions the last 30 years, except for the last hour of the last night when Hillary Clinton spoke. The closing rally in Philadelphia was awesome. Bon Jovi was great. Bruce really delivered. You know, President Obama gave a great talk. And then it came to Hillary, and she was a damp squib. And this was in part a failure of the Democratic establishment, which tilted the playing field towards her for the nomination from the beginning, and just a larger artifact of the fact that the Democrats just didn't have much of a bench. And I think she went for an understandable strategy of disqualifying Trump. And on most levels, you would say she succeeded in disqualifying Trump. His unfavorable rating was 60%. 60% of people didn't think he was prepared or suited for the office. And it just didn't matter, because the desire for change overwhelmed that. And he was able, he was a really impressive message-based and performance-based candidate, and that message resonated in the rural areas and among the white working class. And where I think there has to be a lot of introspection among Democrats has already begun. It's not just the party didn't have appeal to those working class voters who used to be Democrats. It didn't even want to have appeal to those voters.
Dahlia, where do you think the errors were?
Well, I think one of the things we really miss, Josh, is the errors in how voting works in this country. We forget that this was the first election post Shelby County in 2013, where the Roberts Court, by a 5-4 margin, gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act. And then we all kind of went on screensave and said, well, that's pretty terrible, and ignored the fact that states like Texas and North Carolina and Wisconsin were passing some of the most appalling voter suppressive legislation we have ever seen. Sometimes within hours of the Shelby County decision coming down. And so you can say, oh, you know, African Americans didn't turn out for Hillary. But I think you also have to recognize, and Ari Berman at The Nation has been doing yeoman's work on this, there were 868 fewer polling places in America on Tuesday, partly as a result of shenanigans that were happening in the states, shenanigans that were done in violation of court orders that said, hey, you still can't do this. And we saw Texas and North Carolina party apparatus going ahead and doing it. And so I think as much as you want to, you know, bitch and moan about how this played out, one thing to really say is that if you suppress the vote, if you spend 4 years systematically trying to keep certain groups from voting, whether they're African Americans or they're students or they're the elderly, sometimes it works out. And so I think the margins are close enough that we should at least say, let's not go on screen save for 4 more years and then file litigation the week before the next presidential election. Let's figure out once and for all that there is no such thing as vote fraud in America. Legislation trying to tamp down on vote fraud in America is pretextual, and let's allow people who want to vote to get out and vote.
See, Dahlia, is there evidence that this really mattered at the margin in her loss? Because the thing is that she underperformed in some states that had new rules like this, like Wisconsin and North Carolina, but then she also managed to lose Michigan and Pennsylvania, which I don't think you can blame on voter suppression activity. And it worries me that if Democrats fixate on this, that they will then end up not doing the introspection that they need to do to figure out how to reverse what was a huge shift among white voters in the upper Midwest. All of these counties, rural counties, small metro counties in Wisconsin that Obama had won, these white voters shifting to Hillary Clinton this time. It's not just a matter of voters not turning up. In fact, a lot of the story about turnout having been poor is an artifact of the fact that the vote hasn't been fully counted. It's not clear that this is going to be a low turnout election once all the votes are in. What is clear is that you have a lot of parts in the country, very white areas in the North, where a lot of people who voted for Obama last time voted for Trump this time.
I don't dispute for one nanosecond that this was a campaign that failed and that failed to hear the voices of white workers who felt that the party had abandoned them, males who felt that the party did not care about them. I don't dispute your initial opening premise about what went wrong for one second. But I think it's awfully important to understand that when the U.S. Supreme Court says as a matter of law in 2013 that discrimination is over in America, so let's move on, and that the states race to make sure that the voting apparatus suppresses minorities, I think it's absolutely symbolic of an America that has left certain voters behind. And so I just think to fail to at least recognize what that does is to just change the subject. I'm not disputing what you're saying, but I think this is ever so important going forward. We really have to think about the fact that voters are told they can't vote.
Look, Hillary Clinton deserves everything you said. And if your plan for the 2 years, 4 years from 2012 to 2013 to 2016, I'm going to spend the first 2 years earning $60 million making speeches to Goldman Sachs, and then the next 2 years running for president as the defender of Dodd-Frank and the common man, that's not a good plan. The Clintons were undone, as they've been undone for a long time, by their greed, their personal greed. It wasn't enough for Bill Clinton to go on and run the Red Cross or Columbia University. He had to make $250 million selling access, not just to a past president, but to a possible future president. Their behavior was really bad, and I think it caught up with them, and it was visible. People understood that. This is a broader problem. The left has become more left, but it's become a different kind of left. It's become a left that has said, you know, the most important problems facing America? People are not choosing Halloween costumes that I like. And we are going to make it a real project to not just deplore, but actually terrorize people if they make Halloween costumes. And oh, by the way, over the past year, 4,000 stories in the New York Times about transgender rights. I'm kind of sympathetic to that cause. I think people who, you know, are in that situation deserve, you know, respect. But, you know, it is a very, very small group of people. And other people who are much more numerous have, you know, even also more urgent problems. As we have had this boutique left, this Samantha Bee John Oliver left, as Ross Douthat points out, it is left behind the sort of things that a more moderate social democratic left would want to address. And understandably, the voters for that more moderate social democratic left say, I don't see anything here for me, and I'm not treated with respect. I mean, if your message, if I'm a middle-aged white male, you know, who's feeling like my income isn't all it could be, and maybe my status in society isn't what I believe it should be, and your message for me is, well, you're wrong about what your status should be, and actually our advice to you, sir, is to hurry up and die. You say, well, you may think I'm wrong, and maybe I am wrong, but I have the same vote as anybody else, and if I'm going to defend my status, I'm going to use the instrument I have. And so I that debate, which was so alive in the Democratic Party in the 1990s, where Democrats generally got right answers, that debate flared again during the Obama years. It became a place, I think, where people parked some of their disappointments with President Obama, who was uncriticizable within the Democratic world, so they took on these boutique causes. And Hillary Clinton's whole message was, we're going to follow one historic first with another historic first. We are going to redress what we see as wrong status balances in our society, and those who don't like it, they can vote for whomever they want, and they did.
The undoing of Democrats in this election was the coalition of the ascendant and a belief in a demographic determinism that was both geographically and ideologically limiting, because that's coalition that's heavily dependent on urban areas or basically writing off rural areas. And what that means, you're not going to win governorships. You're probably not going to win the House. You have a lot of trouble in Senate races, but you can win the presidency. If you win the presidency. If you don't win the presidency, you have lost everything up and down the ballot, and that's what happened this time. And there was no effort to reach out at all to those voters culturally because of this coalition and what it considers important and what it wants to hear. So there's no effort to even make a nod on guns or a nod on abortion or a nod on immigration or really on anything. And if, as David points out, if your strategy for this voter seems to be just to wait until they die and to write them off and say they're the past and celebrate a new coalition that's built on various ethnicities voting as a block, you are likely to create a reaction, and they did.
I think that it is so grossly unfair to suggest that the interests of the left really are absolutely hegemonically controlled by an interest in Halloween costumes and politically correctness. It's as unfair as saying that all Trump voters are racist. I think that the left in this country is absolutely concerned about the environment, about women's rights, about unions. It is so much more than that. And I would just say, as my second point, that when we abandon white workers in this country, it has some correlation, at least, to the dismantling, the systemic dismantling of unions and worker protections in this country. So I think it's not something that simply happened. I think that it was something that was done. And it's just, we have to be really, really careful in responding to identity politics with more identity politics.
But Dahlia, would you at least say, hey, America, wear whatever Halloween costume you want. We have more important problems.
I would say absolutely. And I would also say that Hillary absolutely gave massive, massive quarter on the guns issue. Rich suggests that she was, you know, as polarizing as she could be. It's not true. If you listen to what she said, if you look at what her policies were, they were not seize all guns from America, despite the fact that Trump said that over and over again. So I think that the truth is that there are concessions being made on the left, and that in some instances, the right moves further right instead of meeting halfway.
The problem I have with this cultural discussion, and I think, David, what you're pointing to in the sort of exhausting political correctness of the left is a real thing. And I think the Halloween costume overreach, and I think this is more than just an issue on college campuses. I think elements of this are bleeding out in a very real way into the broader society and annoying people who feel like, I just want to be left alone to lead my normal life and not have somebody in New York telling me what I should do all the time. On the other hand, it tends to be that the people who really take up that mantle about how awful political correctness is are the sorts of people who are the most eager about Donald Trump. And political correctness ends up meaning whatever the speaker wants it to mean, whatever socially disapproved of statement or activity they want to engage in. And because political correctness doesn't fundamentally mean anything, it can describe any restriction on activity in polite society, people will use a campaign against political correctness as a cover for whatever racist, sexist, anti-Semitic activity they want to engage in. And the problem is, I don't see a way to have a productive anti-PC politics that doesn't end up with Trumpism. Is there a more productive way to channel that those objections?
It shouldn't be an anti-PC politics. It should be an anti-PC resistance with humor. The reaction is not, by all means, you know, in fact, people should wear more insulting Halloween costumes. Find the most insulting Halloween costume you possibly can and wear it with pride. That's not the message.
But that's like Milo Yiannopoulos, Breitbart. Right. There is a very real strand of like, let's offend people because it's fun to offend people.
And cruelty is bad. Rudeness is bad. It's just when this thing began to arise, when these movements begin to arise, the reaction of liberal-minded people should have been, oh, knock it off. Just be quiet. No, that's ridiculous. And you don't need a case for why college deans should not be fired for not policing Halloween costumes. You just need a healthy human resistance to the ridiculous.
And Go ahead. Sorry, Dawn. I was going to say, Democrats, they just got used to the idea they didn't need to engage in any defensive cultural politics whatsoever. They could be perpetually on offense. You know, and if the Bill Clinton of 1992 were running this year, he might very well have said, you know what, Colin Kaepernick, maybe you should stand up for the national anthem. You are an extremely privileged person in this country who's adored and cheered by thousands of people and makes millions of dollars. Maybe just stand up. There's no one in the Democratic Party who's willing to do that now.
Dahlia, quickly before
actually,
we go
Ruth Bader. Ruth Bader Ginsburg
took it back.
Did say that and then walked it back. But I just need to say the idea that we have normalized what Donald Trump said on that bus to Billy Bush, and that's not an absolute assault on women, that it's just tenderhearted identity politics when women balk at that, is really terrifying.
That's not the argument. Of course it's horrible. Of course it's horrible. And it's not, those are not rude remarks. It's a confession of criminal activity. My point, I've been saying through the show, in what is to come, you're going to need the symbols of America, because that's what you're going to be defending. And those symbols are precious, and they should command unanimous respect. You're going to need the anthem. You're going to need the flag. You're going to need the statute, the Iwo Jima statute. You're going to need those things. And the idea that these neo-Nazis who owe allegiance to Vladimir Putin, they're now going to say, that's our flag. That's not their flag. Take it back.
Let us know what you think about cultural politics at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, rebuilding national understanding. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate. And David Frum from The Atlantic is also with us. So to what Rich was mentioning about the left sort of feeling like it can be constantly on offense on cultural politics, I think it's partly because the degree of cultural separation is larger than ever in the country, and it's more tied to politics than ever. I was thinking about that old Pauline Kael quote from 1972, and people get this wrong all the time. She didn't say that she didn't understand how Nixon could have won. What she did say is that she only knew one person who had voted for Nixon, and it reflected sort of the bubble that she lived in. That was at a time when Richard Nixon had taken 33% of the vote in Manhattan. On Tuesday, Donald Trump got 10% of the vote in Manhattan. We've had great difficulty finding appropriate pro-Trump guests to book on this show. And I think you've seen that across cable news, where basically you have to have random people whose sole qualification is that they were for Donald Trump on debating people you've heard of who have other positions. But now that movement that had essentially no representation in elite media, in much of elite politics, now governs the country. And so to figure out how to win back those voters away from this sort of alarming thing they chose, the first thing we have to do is understand these people who we literally don't even know. So what do we do about that?
I think you'll have no difficulty in future booking pro-Trump guests because there is going to be every political scavenger, every opportunist, everybody who wants to make a dishonest dollar, of whom there are no few in Washington, and even some in New York, those people are going to be gravitating to him like maggots to bad meat. And it's going to be an influx. So your booking problems are behind you.
Okay, but I'm more interested in the broad. I mean, I care about booking this show, like it's a part of my life. But more broadly, like I think part of the reason that you ended up with a candidate who had a message that so turned off this group of white voters in the Rust Belt that they didn't realize how badly they were turning off was that literally none of us know these people. We can't. And then there's been all this reporting from Trump country this year. It's not like reporters haven't gotten out in the field and talked to voters about what they want. But the answers you get are sort of so inchoate about exactly what people are upset about and what you could do to make them feel better. I think Donald Trump is going to have a lot of difficulty making these upset people feel better. He's not bringing the manufacturing jobs back. But it's not like there's a really concrete list of demands out of his voters that we could meet and therefore, you know, and therefore placate them.
Josh, don't you think that sort of elides the fact that there's actually tremendous commonality between some of the Bernie voters and some of the Trump voters? I have long suspected that this idea that we live in two completely different worlds kind of ignores the fact that an enormous amount of the electorate would have been for certain of the values that both Trump and Bernie put forward, and obviously not on the margins. But it seems to me that there are very foundational issues on which voters agree, largely that they don't trust government and they hate the 1%. So it seems to me that it's not that we can't talk to each other. It's just that the coded language is so different that we can't align around it. You have to sort of define yourself as one or another. But it seems like the urgency of the issues themselves are something that most voters actually agree on. It's the packaging that breaks down.
But there is this geographic separation. As someone tweeted on Election Day, you know, there are fears about bloody clashes between Trump and Hillary supporters at polling places. And at some point, they're not at the same polling place. They're never going to encounter one another. And Manhattan's a great example. I live in Manhattan. I remember in the Republican primary, the New York Times has this great feature. You can look at each precinct and see where you live and how many people voted. And my wife and I accounted for 20% of the Cruz vote in a precinct. We thought that was quite high. And then I looked at the precinct just south of us, and there was one Cruz voter. I was like, I know that guy. But, you know, again, it just goes to the discussion we were having earlier. I think it's incumbent on all of us, and perhaps especially the left in this circumstance, to have less contempt for these voters and a little bit more empathy, to try to hear their concerns rather than rejecting whatever they believe is retrograde.
But then what do we do about the problem that in part, I mean, let's take Colin Kaepernick, for example. And Colin Kaepernick himself is not a great example, but broadly, the Black Lives Matter movement, I would say two things about it. One is that much of its agenda, if not all of it, is entirely valid. And there are very big problems with the way police in the United States treat especially young Black men, and they have a lot of concerns that ought to be heard in the political process. I also think it is true that the Democratic Party's alignment with that hurt them with white voters in this election. So what do we do if a lot of these voters have complaints that amount to that they dislike the decline of white status in America? They feel threatened by an increasingly minority country. They really are bothered by the idea of taco trucks on every corner. I think a lot of the objection to immigration is not about wage levels and the idea that it's competing down working class wages, but simply about a desire to maintain a more homogenous society. What if the problem is that a lot of the things people want are things that we really can't morally indulge?
Why can't we morally indulge? What if it's true? And I think that this is not just an American problem. This is true throughout the Western world. It's true in Europe. What if the choice is a more diverse society will be a less liberal society? And you can choose. Choose one, diversity or liberalism. What if that's true? I've been arguing for a long time that it is true. It's not a fact of nature. It's not geology that is making the country more diverse. It is a policy. It's a policy that has winners and that has losers. And the winners from that policy include both the immigrants themselves and those who benefit, but owners of capital and of highly skilled labor. those winners tell the losers that you are bad people. You're not only a loser, you're a bad person. You're not allowed to advocate for your own interests, both your economic interest and your cultural interest. Because those cultural feelings, they're valid too. And even if you don't think they're valid, the people who have those feelings have the ballot and they're going to act on those feelings. So my view for a long time, I'm going to say it again, is part of it is if you're going to run a migration policy that is even more massive than the policy of 1880 to 1914, you have to look back on those years and see how violent and contested they were. The bloodiest labor relations on the planet, two presidential assassinations, tumult and strife between groups, that goes with the territory. And the more stable and egalitarian society that you had between the end of the First World War and the early 1980s, that society was produced by less diversity.
So is your idea basically that these people have a gut-level feeling that happens to line up with good... Because the average anti-immigration voter would not explain it that way.
I'm saying is that human beings react in ways that are pretty easy to predict. That one of the things that conservative policymakers should understand, one of the things that conservatism should mean, is you govern your country according to the human nature. And if you look at human nature and in some way human nature does not agree with your feelings about what human beings should be like, you're going to find that human nature is more resistant, that it is your opinions that are probably going to have to yield because the nature won't.
Dahlia, do you think Democrats are going to have to give it all on immigration? It's been interesting to me how the Democratic Party's position on this has sort of quietly slid quite far to the left over the last 8 years, to the point where the default position is that you can't deport somebody unless they have committed a crime. Do they need a position that is more centrist on immigration?
I mean, A, it's not factually true, right? We know that Obama has deported more people than his predecessors. And we know that the position is, the administration has been pretty tough on immigration. So it seems to me that, to David's point, I think it's true that we have to be rational about what we can sustain. And I would say the conversation around the Affordable Care Act has been really interesting because it's been making a similar point, right? That employers of small businesses simply cannot finance this and that progressives need to talk about that. But I do think that we have to be really, really careful not to conflate what seems a rational policy position with the part of this that is absolutely xenophobic and absolutely fearful and absolutely, there is a part of this that is irrational and that is really, I think, seeing a groundswell of support that just has to do with this fantasy about making America great again and forgetting all the constituencies. You can dismiss it as political correctness, but all the constituencies for whom America was not great before.
Rich, I want to get you in here.
Yeah, I just think any policy, there are going to be some people that support it for bad reasons or don't have good intentions. Maybe a lot of Bernie Sanders' program, people are excited about it because they literally hated bankers or they're envious of successful people. But I don't think we would dismiss Bernie's program because of that. We'd evaluate it rationally on its merits and whether it's good for the country or not. And I think tightening up on immigration is a rational policy that's good for the country. And it's just not true that President Obama has been the deporter in chief. It's based on an accounting gimmick, and we don't need to get in all the technicalities. But basically, it used to be if you catch someone right at the border, you turn them around, they leave. That's not counted as a deportation. The Obama administration began counting them as deportations to inflate the number and to make it seem as they'd really crack down on enforcement to make the case for an amnesty. And when President Obama was under pressure from immigration activists, he actually himself said that this number was misleading.
Well, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dahlia Lithwick, and David Frum. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by